intervene. Your silence is commanded.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. I'm going to call our third case for today, 0318-1307, Christy Hafferman v. St. Clair Health Care Foundation, Inc. Now, I believe that the court is going to get some materials through these computers, and I see you have, representing Mr. Hafferman, Christy Hafferman, you've got a computer, and you're doing exhibits. Have you seen these? What's going to be exhibited?
Your Honor, there's statutes
and everything that's in the record. It's just a matter of extracting them and putting them in electronic form so we can show off our capabilities.
Yes.
Yours and ours. Right. Do you have any objection, counsel? Mr. Duffy? Mr. Laufenberg? Pardon me? Fine. We'll proceed if something is shown that you do have an objection to, that it's not in the record. You may make that objection. If it is in the record, whether we see it electronically or on paper, should not make any difference to anyone. All right. We'll hear the way the schedule is set forth. Attorney Duffy will argue for 15 minutes for Christy Hafferman. Attorney Laufenberg will argue for the amicus for 10 minutes for Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers. Mr. Tsao will argue for 30 minutes on behalf of Dr. Vanger. And then Attorney Duffy will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Right? Okay. Mr. Duffy, you are...
Thank you, Your Honor.
Proceed.
Members of the court, counsel. I'm accompanied today by Richard Schultz and Jeremy Young, also counsel for Toby and his parents. I am going to concentrate on the statutory interpretation issues raised by this case. Mr. Laufenberg is going to concentrate more on the constitutional issues and also bringing Waddell's broader view to this case. Essentially, we view this case as raising one main question, and that is, did the legislature intend that developmentally disabled children have less time or more time than otherwise healthy children to file their medical malpractice suits? The trial court said more time. Court of Appeals dissent said more time. The Court of Appeals majority said less time. This is essentially a tale of three statutes, all relating to when a medical malpractice case must be filed. The interplay is complex, as this Court has noted in prior cases, and it creates a problem. That problem is it provides no clear statute of limitations or repose for developmentally disabled children. This Court's previously noted the problem but hadn't had to decide it in the previous cases. Today, it must confront the issue squarely. As you well know, the Court's job here is to divine legislative intent and put it into effect. If it can avoid constitutional issues, it must. If it can divine the intent from the language of the statutes, that's the first, that's the most preferable. In this case, we don't believe that can be done. The three statutes, 893.55, imposes general statute of limitations on medical malpractice claims. We believe that's unambiguous. 893.56 imposes a separate statute of repose for actions against health care providers by minors, but excludes minors who are developmentally disabled. We also feel that's unambiguous. 893.16, we believe, is ambiguous when read in light of 893.56. It establishes a statute of repose for minors, but it excludes minors with claims against health care providers, not accommodating the fact that developmentally disabled minors with medical malpractice claims are not covered by 893.56 and therefore essentially have no statute of limitations or repose. When the language of the statute...
They don't fit under insane or imprisoned?
Pardon?
They don't fit under insane or imprisoned?
I believe imprisoned has been removed. Insane has been changed to mentally ill.
Right. They don't fit under mentally ill?
According to prior statement by this court, mental illness and developmental disability may but don't necessarily coincide. We don't believe that categorizing Toby as mentally ill will solve the problem here, because if he's categorized as mentally ill, 893.16 only gives him five additional years to file a lawsuit. Since he is not in the age 10 statute of repose under 893.56, he's generally controlled by the general malpractice statute of limitations and repose under 893.55, so between 3 and 5 years depending upon certain circumstances. If he gets the additional 5 years by being mentally ill under 893.16, that means he must file within 8 to 10 years. That means that some developmentally disabled children will be forced to file before age 10. This court has previously said that children have an absolute right to file medical malpractice cases until their 10th birthday. This court has also observed that the legislative intent is apparently to give developmentally disabled children more time than healthy children, so it gives them less time, thereby frustrating legislative intent, and also creates constitutional problems of equal protection.
The trial court and court of appeals had more time or less time. What about equal time?
Equal time frustrates legislative intent, as has been pointed out by this court, understandably in dicta, since it wasn't faced with deciding the question, but this court has previously stated that it believes the legislature's intent was to provide developmentally disabled children with more time than healthy children to file their medical malpractice cases.
Where do you get that, counsel?
I get that from the Acher case, paragraph 73.
Right, I was familiar with Acher.
I can imagine. it appears from the admittedly dicta comments in Acher, because it wasn't faced with the question, it appears that this court has reached a conclusion that's consistent with our suggestion, with the trial court's conclusion, with the Court of Appeals dissent, and with Judge Crabb in the Western District, and that is the legislative intent is clearly to give disabled children more time rather than the same amount of time or less time to file malpractice cases.
So where is it in the statute?
I'm sorry?
So where is the legislative intent in the statute?
Well, that's why we have to look to legislative history. I think when looking at legislative history, since the question isn't solved by the plain language of the statute, I think looking at legislative history does provide legislative intent. Before 1977, the predecessor to 893.16 provided a minor with a claim against a health care provider could file suit until 1 year after his minority ceased.
You're talking about 56 now?
That was 893.33, which is the predecessor to 893.16. In 1977, that's when the legislature created 893.235, which was the predecessor to 893.56. That created an age 10 statute of repose for non-developmentally disabled minors with claims against health care providers. At the same time, in the same act, it amended 893.33, which is the predecessor to 893.16, to exclude all minors with claims against health care providers. So there was a disparity there. At the same time, carving out only developmentally disabled minors from 893.56, they could have, but did not, do the same thing in 893.33. They could have said, That all children with, all children except as provided in 893.56. They didn't do that. They carved out all children with health care, with medical malpractice claims, which left developmentally disabled children with medical malpractice claims without a statute of limitations. That's the, that was where the plan apparently went awry.
In 56, if I recall the legislative history, that it seemed to me that it was created to decrease the time otherwise available to minors for bringing medical malpractice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You don't debate that.
No. And in fact, that's why taking developmentally disabled children out of a statute that otherwise decreases the time shows a legislative intent not to decrease the time.
The intent was, when you look at it, was I think it was a written, handwritten amendment that was put in at that time. No explanation.
It has emerged from some of the cases and the briefing that it may have been a handwritten addition to the bill as printed. To me, that might account for the fact, the incongruity between the creation of 893.56 predecessor and the amendment of the 893.16 predecessor. Had developmental disability been in the bill as originally introduced, the court may have, the legislature may have picked up on that and understood that it couldn't just take out all children with medical malpractice claims out of 893.16, that they would be leaving developmentally disabled children adrift. So perhaps that is, perhaps that's an explanation for why the legislature dropped a stitch, as has been, as it has been explained. But however it happened, that leaves us now with this dropped stitch and how to repair it. Since this legislative history, I believe, is plainly shows legislative intent to give developmentally disabled children more time than rather than the same or less, what to do with it, how to put it into effect. The petitioner's and Waddell's suggestion is consistent with the views of the trial court, Judge Dykeman's dissent in the Court of Appeals, and Judge Crabb in the Zilke case, which is cited in the briefs. Section 893.16 can be interpreted in a way to eliminate the inconsistency with 893.56, simply so, where it says, except for actions against health care providers, interpret that to mean except as provided in 893.56.
Counselor, I'd like you to address a little different part of that statute in line with our decision in the Storm case, where we said that the mental illness that's referred to in statute must predate the act of malpractice. And here you're relying on the act of malpractice for the disability rather than having a disability that predates it. Can you talk about that a little bit for me, please?
Glad to, Your Honor. According to this court's holding in Storm v. Legion, the real issue is whether Toby's disability began before Dr. Vanger's last negligent treatment. This case is unlike, we think, the Carlson case cited by Dr. Vanger, where the cause of action accrues at the same time as the injury and after all the negligence. Then it is clear that the cause of action and the disability commence at the same time. In this case, Dr. Vanger served plaintiff with an interrogatory, which was responded to, and Dr. Vanger subsequently filed that with the trial court in support of summary judgment and filed it with the Court of Appeals in support of interlocutory review, asking the plaintiffs to list the dates on which Dr. Vanger was negligent. The response said that we believe the negligence of Donald Vanger began as early as the fifth month of Christy Haferman's pregnancy, or approximately September 1990, continued after delivery when the baby was not developed a pneumothorax and was not properly ventilated. So for two reasons, we think that there is at very least, a factual dispute as to whether the disability existed at the time Toby's cause of action accrued. Number one, It can't accrue before he's born. When he's born, the die has already been cast. At least there's a factual dispute. And number two, the last negligent treatment. It is clear that once Dr. Vanger stopped treating him, the die was cast. He was already developmentally disabled. So we feel in either event, at least there's a factual issue precluding summary judgment, justifying this court to overturn the Court of Appeals.
I still am having a little bit of trouble in determining how you predate the negligence with the disability. To me, you're saying the disability arose perhaps over a course of time from negligent treatment that was given during that time and as a result of it. But our holding in Storm says the mental illness predates. Okay, and I'm not getting predates from you. That's what I'm having difficulty with.
But Storm also admitted the possibility that the mental illness was caused by earlier treatment by the same defendant doctor. It said that the relevant date to look at was the last date of treatment. Keying on Robinson versus Sinai, continuum of negligent care, the date to look at is the last date of treatment. If the disability predated that date, even if it was caused by prior treatment by the same defendant doctor, this court in Storm apparently considered that as satisfying 893.16 sub 3.
See, I'm reading that part of Storm as the last date of treatment as being something that keeps you within the statute of limitations. And I don't have a problem with that in this case. I also read Storm as saying that this disability that we're talking about has to predate the malpractice. The beginning of the malpractice. If you don't know when the injury occurred, and that's a question of fact, I can certainly understand that. And am I reading Storm wrong, that the statute does not say the mental disability must predate the malpractice?
I'd be the last person to say you're reading Storm wrong.
Well, you can correct me. I'm not infallible.
I can tell you the way I read Storm.
Okay, that's what I'd like to know.
Is that defendant made the same argument you're making.
Uh-huh.
That seemed to be the argument that was dispatched by Storm in that portion of the opinion.
Okay.
It seemed to dispatch the argument that the disability had to predate the first day of negligence and instead concluded that the disability had to predate the last day of negligence, if alleging a continuum of care, which we are.
All right. And so you would say the same thing for someone being 18 years of age, that sits in the same standard as the mental illness criteria then of subsection 16.
I don't know if I understand the question. Once you're 18, you don't have the benefit of 893.16 anymore.
Right, that's right.
But I'd say anyone alleging a continuum of negligent care, the important date when it comes to 893.16 sub 3 would be the last date of negligent care. I don't know if that answers the question, but...
Well, I'll think about it. I may just not have thought about it that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Apparently my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Laufenberg.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lynn Laufenberg, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the court on this important case on behalf of Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers. In the short time that I have, I'd like to speak to the interwoven issues of legislative intent, statutory interpretation, established public policy, and potential constitutional ramifications of various proposed interpretations of the statutes involved in this case. Unfortunately, as the court has already observed, there is no specific legislative history to explain the last-minute insertion, apparently handwritten, of the term developmental disability into Section 893.56. It is clear, however, that when that term was inserted into that statute, children with developmental disability were effectively excepted from the shortened period of limitation established by Section 893.56, a shortened period which was generally approved as constitutionally valid by this court in Acre. The public policy reflected by the legislation, that is, to accept developmental disabled children from the shortened period of limitation, is supportive of this court's observations in Acre that, one, all minors have at least until age 10 to file their lawsuits for medical malpractice, and two, that the legislature likely intended to afford those minors with developmental disability more time, not less time, to bring their claims. On the state level, Chapter 55, the public policy, this public policy is a result of a long tradition, legislative action at both the state and federal level, which is aimed at protecting and assisting those with developmental disabilities. On the state level, Chapter 55, Civil Commitment, Chapter 51, Protective Placement, reflect the state's policy to provide a full range of treatment and rehabilitation services to those with developmental disabilities, among other people with other disabilities. Chapter 880 facilitates guardianships to provide protection to both the person and the assets of those with developmental disabilities as well as other disabilities. Chapter 115, enacted at Wisconsin being at the forefront of enactments in 1960 and predating even federal legislation, provides for the education of all handicapped children, of which those with developmental disabilities are a subclass. In the mid-70s, Congress enacted the Education of All Handicapped Children Act and expressed a policy of improving educational results for those with handicapping conditions, including those who would be considered developmentally disabled.
I just want to interrupt you and ask you one question. What is your final interpretation of all these statutes?
Without a question, developmentally disabled children must be afforded more time than non-developmentally disabled children who have medical malpractice claims.
And what time is that?
That time should be the same amount of time afforded to all other minors with tort claims arising from other causes. In other words, as Mr. Duffy pointed out, there was a legislative drafting mistake. When developmentally disabled, certainly the legislature intended to shorten the time generally for minors to bring their medical malpractice claims to 10 years.
What's that?
However, pardon me?
What is it going to be precisely? I want to know precisely. When is the last date you can bring this lawsuit?
1 year beyond the age of majority.
Okay.
So you have 19 years.
Yes.
I know you have a short time, but I appreciate your outlining the history. Now, the legislature, knowing what has taken place in the Aker case, other cases, has done nothing on this. Does that evince a legislative intent, just doing nothing?
Unfortunately, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. As this Court has observed in other cases, sometimes legislative inactivity is significant, and if you can find evidence that there was some effort made to countervail or counteract an apparent adverse interpretation, but that was defeated, that may be significant. In this case, I know of no evidence that the legislature has entered this field one way or the other. So I don't know that inactivity, since this court's decision in Aker, is of much help to the court in resolving this issue. I don't think we can say that it represents either legislative acquiescence in this court's observations or a legislative difference with this court's observations, since we've not heard from the legislature on this issue.
Counsel, show me the statute and how you interpret it where you arrive at 1 year beyond the age of majority.
Sure. If you look at 893.16, which I believe states, if I can find the exact language, it says, as written, if a person entitled to bring an action is at the time the cause of action accrues, either under the age of 18 years, and then it says, except for claims for malpractice, and I don't know if I have the exact language there, an action may be commenced within 2 years after the disability ceases. Obviously, if you go then to the actions for malpractice, which is governed by Section 893.56, which is entitled Action by Minors for Malpractice, it says, except everyone, all minors with claims for malpractice have 10 years, except those who have a developmental disability. So they're excepted from that shortened period of statute, certain limitations. So as Mr. Duffy suggests, the only rational way to read Section 893.16 to accomplish legislative intent and goal to increase the time or accept developmental disabled children from the shortened period of limitation is to read it to say, accept claims for malpractice, to read except as provided in Section 893.56.
Okay, but why, you said 1 year beyond the age of majority. 893.16 has a lot of problems, but the first problem is it talks about 2 years after the disability ceases.
I thought that had been amended to be 1 year.
I'm looking at it
now. I think as originally enacted, it was 2 years, but there were some amendments that removed imprisonment as one of the disabling conditions, and it also shortened that time after the disability ceases to 1 year. And the disability then that developmentally disabled children would be subject to is not their developmental disability, but their minority. In other words, their minority continues to toll their period of time for filing their lawsuit until 1 year passed the end of that disability, meaning 1 year past the time when they turn age 18. Just as other minors who are injured by torts from other causes.
But isn't that inconsistent with your argument that, look, now we're going to interpret this after we've discerned the legislative intent to provide more protection for developmentally disabled? Aren't you interpreting it to provide the same protection?
More protection for developmentally disabled children injured by malpractice.
Okay.
Not more protection for developmentally disabled children generally. There's a subclass of plaintiffs we're dealing with these statutes, and that is minors injured by malpractice. And within that class, we have those who are developmentally disabled and those who are not. And the point is, within that class, the developmentally disabled children are excepted from the shortened period of limitation and continue to be subject to the general tolling provisions for minority that would apply to other tort causes of action.
Counsel, aren't you asking us to overrule a specific conclusion in STORM where we say the legislature has indicated an express intent to curtail the application of Section 893.16 to medical malpractice actions with respect to minors? Section 893.16 excludes children under the age of 18 that are bringing actions against health care providers from the tolling provisions of the statute.
I appreciate, Justice Rogenczyk, that that's what STORM says, because but STORM wasn't dealing with this issue. STORM was dealing with a different disability issue, that is mental illness involving an adult.
I know, but you're sure familiar with our precedent that any time we pick something up and decide it is not dicta, according to our precedent.
I think that discussion, Justice Rogenczyk, was a discussion of the background that was getting the court to the decision in STORM was not necessary to the court's decision in STORM. It was reciting the situation involving minors as an illustration of the fact that the legislature intended that persons could be suffering from more than one disability at the same time.
I appreciate exactly what you're saying, and, you know, were I still sitting on the Court of Appeals, it would be persuasive to me. But I'm not anymore, and we have a lot of precedent that says when we make statements like this, you can't just say they're dicta because we don't express dicta.
Well, I guess it depends upon what the definition of dicta is. I've always understood dicta to mean those statements that are not essential to the holding in the case.
Right.
And I think that's what this would fall within that definition. It's certainly the court's prerogative to determine what is dicta and what is not. If it isn't dicta, then certainly, I think because this issue is squarely presented for decision, this court has to face it, and in facing it would have to overturn or overrule those statements or clarify those statements.
Or at least withdraw the language.
Yes, that would be appropriate as well. I see my time is up.
Let me just ask you. Go ahead, Justice Trotsky.
Lautenberg, I think I'd like to share my thinking, my current thinking, with you and get your reaction. We start with the 1977 session of the legislature. And there's a bill being debated, Assembly Bill 705, and it is the predecessor to 89356. And people reading that bill see insanity in the bill. And someone says, we ought to also protect people with developmental disabilities. And someone writes out a floor amendment, and it's adopted. Because you don't vote against the people with developmental disabilities. Okay. Then the 1979 session of the legislature comes along. And in, Chapter 323, a whole lot of different sections are amended. And in 89316, they put that exception in for health care cases because this, by and large, is a bill to help doctors in a heavily Democratic legislature, I might add. And they just don't catch the incongruity that because of action taken earlier, it is having a completely contrary effect for children with developmental disabilities. It seems to me, my conclusion is that the legislature could not have intended to discriminate against children with developmental disabilities. Because if they did intend to do that, it just would be unconstitutional. And so the effect of that is I would simply ignore that language in 89356. Unfortunately, I don't think that helps your case.
Well, I don't know of any precedent for ignoring legislative statements that would accept developmentally accept developmentally disabled children, which was clearly the legislative intent, to accept them from the shortened period of limitation. I think the remedy has to be in the direction I've suggested. I certainly agree that to conclude, as the majority did in the Court of Appeals and as the Fund argues on this appeal, and it's amicus, that to give them a shorter period, to make them subject to the adult statute of limitations, would certainly discriminate against developmentally disabled children. In light, particularly, this Court's recent holding in Ferdinand. But I don't know how you escape, and I guess that's something the Court as a whole is going to have to struggle with, how you escape the clear legislative intent reflected by that floor amendment to accept developmentally disabled children from a shortened period of limitation for malpractice claims. There's no question that the statutes don't read the way they should. There was a drafting error, no question about it. But I think this Court can hearken back to a case it decided last term in which it acknowledged that the statute at issue, and that was the Lagerstrom case involving the question of collateral source benefits, admissibility in medical malpractice cases, wasn't as clear as it should have been because it didn't deal with a lot of existing case law and statutory law that related to collateral benefits, subrogation, et cetera. And the Court read that statute in a way and directed that it be applied in the way to accomplish apparent legislative intent without creating a constitutional problem, which in my view would have been to defer to individual jurors the public policy determination of whether the collateral source rule should or shouldn't apply in a particular lawsuit. So I think there is precedent for this Court to, and as Court stated in other terms, in other cases, it can insert words, ignore words, as Justice Prosser does suggest here, but the question is which words do you ignore, and do you do violence to legislative intent by ignoring those words as opposed to inserting different words in place of the language the legislature chose to use, which will in effect implement legislative intent.
It would seem to me, I don't think that I could dispute in any rational way that in the 1977 session of the legislature, there was probably an intent to provide a longer period of limitation. But this language here, except actions against health care providers, is in a subsequent session of the legislature. So it seems to me that intent has to have been undone.
I'm afraid you're ahead of me and in advance of me on the sequence of these enactments. I had assumed, and maybe wrongfully so, that the same session of the legislature put the exception for health care actions into 893.16 as adopted 893.56. That was my understanding, and if I'm in error about that, I cannot respond to your question.
I think it probably replicated what was in 893.235.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought it was just a reenactment of the same statute in 1979.
That's right.
They didn't solve the problem. They may have had an opportunity to solve the problem. They didn't do it. But the problem wasn't created in 1979. It was created in 1977, as I understand the situation.
Do you see an equal protection issue if minors with developmental disability have the same statute of limitations as just minors without such a disability?
No.
So it has to be equal or greater.
That's right. I think it can't be less. And among the class of minors with developmental disabilities who have malpractice claims, you can't treat them differently, as would be the case if the court adopted one of the arguments that Dr. Vanger uses, that you should discriminate depending upon whether the minor's developmental disability resulted from the malpractice or existed independent of the malpractice or existed when the cause of action accrued versus existed because of the malpractice. So I think if you had that subset of developmentally disabled children and you gave those children with a developmental disability whose disability resulted from the malpractice less time than you gave the developmentally disabled children whose disability did not result from the malpractice, I think you would, in effect, be discriminating against that subset of developmentally disabled children as is reflected by the standard for discrimination most recently addressed in this court's decision in Ferdon.
Well, counsel, we discriminate against those who have malpractice performed against them when they're 17 as opposed to those who have it performed against them when they're 18.
But those are not developmentally disabled children.
Well, it's a statutory criteria in subsection 16. If you're under 18 years of age, then you have an opportunity at least to look at this section of the statutes. But if, in fact, you're over 18 years of age and you're not mentally ill, then you can't use it.
Yes, but the point is not that those children are, all children are in that, those separate categories are treated the same. You're not treating different sets of minors differently as you would be treating different sets of developmentally disabled minors differently if you accepted one of the defense arguments in this case. I think that once you have that breakoff point of age 18, then everybody above age 18, regardless of their condition, is treated the same. Everybody below age 18.
But isn't that because we perceive those folks who are under 18 when they're harmed as not having the ability to proceed on their own claim, the same way we perceive those who are mentally ill as not being able to proceed on their own claim, correct?
Yes.
So I guess I don't see that there's not a parallel here, but
I don't see the parallel, and it may be because I'm not quite on track with your analysis, Justice Rogenczak.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Laufenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Tsong? Are we going to get our computer to work?
Is this working?
Possibly. Good. My question for you, if this, since I'm always a little hesitant that technology will work, I view it as trying to put your child on stage and they never do what you want them to do when you ask them to do it. Do you have printed handouts of what you were going to show for the court?
Your Honor, I don't have copies for all the members of the court. I was going to leave a copy with the marshal so that the court could have it afterwards.
All right. If this doesn't work, I suggest you give them a copy, and then let's duplicate it, if you would. And so you will get the benefit of the exhibits.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. I'd like to address two issues. First, the interplay between Sections 893.16 and 893.56. I think some of the audio visuals that I have, I think we'll clear that up. And then second, address the application of the statutory scheme as we understand the legislature intended to this case. First, on the issue of the statutory interpretation, it's somewhat surprising the Court of Appeals came out where it did in finding that 893.55 applied rather than 893.56 in light of this Court's clear statements in Storm and Acre about how those statutes came into being in the legislative tent in that regard. And to echo what Justice Crossan was talking about, let me just show you.
Oh, good. Counsel, you'll have to stand in front of the microphone. I'll move the microphone over. Just twist the microphone.
There you go. I apologize for this copy being kind of bad, for the visual being kind of bad. This is a copy of Assembly Bill 705 that Justice Prosser referenced.
I have to tell you, Counsel, we're used to reading material like this. In fact, in the briefs, it comes through very poorly sometimes. So.
You don't have to apologize.
Yeah, right.
There are a couple of key points for the Court. In 1977, the legislature made five findings about the need to reduce the time of minors to bring actions in Mandel cases from 18 years to a lower amount of time.
Excuse me. Could you move the mic over?
Oh, sorry.
Just bend it up so it can go right. Thank you.
And these findings are discussed in Acre, but the key one, if you look at the bottom, and D says that the interests of minor children can be adequately and fully protected by adopting the same time limit for bringing actions as applies to adults, except in the case of very young children. And then E says that the interests of children are fully protected if they may be brought by age 10. So those are the findings. And the legislature did two things to implement those findings. They enacted Section 893.235, which is the precursor to 893.56, which is the minor statute of limitations and repose in Med-Mal cases. And they also amended Section 893.33. And this is what Justice Prosser and counsel were talking about a few minutes ago, that the original exception for health care actions was in 893.33 in 1977, and 2 years later, it was all recodified as 893.16, and that was carried forward. And so let me start with 893.33, because this is important. So let me switch slides on you. Again. Okay. In 1978, with the amendment that we just talked about, here's the change that the legislature made, and it's underlined. Prior to 1978, there were three classes of disability that could give rise to additional tolling: minority, insanity, and imprisonment. And for purposes of this slide, I've made minority in red and insanity and imprisonment in blue, and I'll explain that in a minute why I've done that. And the change that the legislature made in 1977 was to add the clause that's in italics and underlined. It's except for actions against healthcare providers. And as I discussed a moment ago, the clear intent was to reduce the amount of time that minors could bring actions against healthcare providers. What's important about the amendment that they made is that this clause, except for actions against healthcare providers, only applied to the category of disability, which is minority. It did not apply to insanity or imprisonment. And as the Court noted in Storm, the use of the semicolon later in 893.16 shows that it only applied, that it was only a carve-out for instances where the injured party was a minor. So the next slide, going forward, 1980 comes along, 2 years later, and 893.33 gets incorporated with a number of other provisions in the 893.16. And again, the same distinction is made, except for actions against health care providers, is delineated as applying only to minority status and not to other disabilities. And it's important to note that prior to 1978, and going back, back into the mid-1800s, it was always the case that you could have stacking of disability tolling. If you were a minor and also insane, you could have the benefit of both. And so what the legislature was doing in 1977 and 1979 was just carving out Med-Mal cases brought by minors, but not also addressing, other disabilities. And that's when we get to 893.56. In 893.56, which at the time in 1977 was 893.235, I again use these colors. What this is meant to denote is that the legislature is showing that it's treating the minority different than other disabilities. It's basically saying any person under the age of 18 who is not under disability by reason of insanity, developmental disability, or imprisonment shall bring an action within 10 years. And here lies the confusion. The Court of Appeals, both the majority and the dissent, construed the phrase in blue
counsel,
highlighted.
We'll have to ask you to move the mic.
Oh, sorry.
And you're being recorded. Is it magnified?
Sure.
It's being recorded.
The Court of Appeals, both the majority and the dissent, and also counsel for the Hafermans and Waddell, construed this phrase in blue as creating an exception. That the legislature accepted them from the minor statute of limitations, when the reality is what the legislature was trying to convey is that all minors are now subject to this new statute of limitations in 893.56, but that these categories of disability in blue, which were unaffected by the amendment, could potentially give rise to additional tolling.
Would that make someone who is insane, developmental, disabled, or imprisoned must bring their cause of action sooner than a minor?
It wouldn't, Your Honor. And here lies let me just explain the way it works. As indicated in Storm and Acre, the legislature clearly moved all minor actions against health care providers to 893.56. That's what's happening right here. But they didn't address additional tolling based on insanity or imprisonment. So this was their kind of inartful way of saying maybe you could have additional tolling. So the way the statute works as amended is adults get the benefit of 893.55, which is 3 years of a date of discovery under 1B, which would be a year from the date of discovery up to 5 years from the date of omission. All minors, whether they have a disability or not, get 10 years. But if you have a disability, such as mental illness, that predated, as Justice Rogan said correctly noted, that predated the negligence or the accrual of the cause of action, you can have additional tolling. It sends you back to 893.16, where it now talks about mental illness and formerly imprisonment, although that was removed. So let me give you an example of how this works. Say you're a child who's 7 years old and you have a mental illness. If you were seven, you wouldn't have the benefit of the 10 years. You wouldn't have the benefit of the second part of 893.56. You would need to rely on 893.55.
When you say benefit of the second part, you're not under the 10-year age. Is that
it? The way 893.56 works, Your Honor, you have a choice. You're either under 893.55, the adult statute of limitations, or you get until you're 10 years of age, whichever is later. Okay? So the person...
You have the 7-year-old.
Okay, so if you're 7 years old, if you got to 10 years old, you'd get 3 years, right? But if you were mentally ill and you're 7 years old, you're better off under 893.55. You'd have 3 years under 55.1A plus you'd have the benefit of 5 years of additional disability tolling because of your mental illness under 893.16. And so the absurd result below that the court...
But isn't the concept in the B that it's a discovery issue?
I'm sorry?
B talks about discovery. That is, when it's discovered, it gives you an extra five. But the child is 7 years old, is mentally ill. You mean developmentally disabled?
Well, I'm talking about, we can talk about developmental disability.
You're talking about mentally ill now.
I'm talking about mentally ill because mentally ill is squarely in the 93.
All right.
I'm just giving that as an example.
Okay.
But they would have a 7-year-old would have a choice. They could proceed under the injury accrual rule in 55-1A. They could proceed under the discovery rule in 55-1B. Or they could proceed under the 10-year, you know, up to the age of 10, whichever is later, whichever benefited them the most. But my point is, what the clause in blue in 893.56 was intended to convey was not, as the court below thought, to accept or carve out a class of minors and treat them differently. All it was meant to be was a placeholder to indicate that the amendment of the disability tolling statute only applied to age. It did not also apply to insanity or at the time imprisonment. That as to those people, if they had a disability that predated the accrual of the cause of action, they could benefit from additional tolling. And construed in that way, which is consistent, it does no violence to the statute or the legislative history to construe it in that way. It's consistent with Storm and Acre and the legislative findings. All they did was they reduced the amount of time for minors from 18 to 10. There was, prior to 1978, stacking of disabilities was available, the tolling periods. If you were a minor and insane, you could stack them. The same is true today. Only instead of having 18 years, as was originally under 893.33, the legislature indicated in the findings that I just showed the court, reduced that amount to 10 years.
Now, counsel, let's take your argument to its logical conclusion.
Sure.
And accept that premise for purposes of this question. What I hear you say is that if you have a person who has a developmental disability that predates the cause of action, that would kick you back into sub 16, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, and it goes back to what Justice Rogan said, point 893.16.3, has always applied only to disabilities that existed at the time the cause of action accrued. And as noted in the Court of Appeals decision in Carlson, and as noted by this court in Storm, it requires that the disability exist, you know, the disability in time one and in time two, there's a negligent act. And as the Court of Appeals correctly found below, that is not the case here. As alleged in the complaint and also in an interrogatory response and also in the reply brief to this court, the petitioner Hafeyans made clear that that's not the sequence of events. And if I may, just since could I have it demonstrative on that, complaints paragraphs 8 and 9 say, beginning on about the 10th day of February 1991, which was the date of the birth, you know, Dr. Vangor and St. Clair were negligent in their treatment, that as a proximate result of that negligent, you know, this minor was injured, including the developmental disability. And then in petitioner's reply brief.
Gotta get your mic again.
Sorry, I'm coming back.
Okay.
Under petitioner's reply brief, they say the disability from which Toby Hafeyman Jr. suffers is cerebral palsy. You know, they seek to establish that disability occurred because he was denied oxygen to his brain just before and after his birth. While the negligence occurred at this time, this negligence proximately caused damage to Toby Hafeyman's brain and, you know, resulted in his cerebral palsy. Therefore, by petitioner's own admissions, they don't predate, but, you know, they don't have a disability that predates the cause of action.
And just so we can follow through, we've heard Mr. Loffenberg's argument that if we draw this distinction, do we have, if you would respond to his equal protection argument, is there an equal protection problem with these two classes of developmentally disabled children. One where the cause of action predates, where the injury predates the cause of action, and one where the injury is caused as a result of the negligence. Are there any equal protection issues there?
There are no equal protection issues because this is a rule that's been codified under Wisconsin law since at least 1842, since Wisconsin was a territory. And what you will find is that any line you draw that draws distinctions, whether it be a limitations line or a repose line or a, you know, disability accrual line, it will leave people on both sides of the line. And the point that the legislature in the 1840s to the present, you know, over 160 years was trying to convey was that we'll give people more time if they had a recognized legal disability before or at the time something bad happens to them. If something later happens to them, let's say, you know, there's a breach of contract, you learn about the breach today, tomorrow you go insane. They said that person doesn't have relief, but that's true of any line you would draw.
Counsel,
yes.
In the context of medical malpractice actions, let's say the negligent action occurred on March 4th. In one case, the developmentally disabled child had that condition on March 3rd, a developmentally disability. In the other case, it was caused by the March 4th operation in the medical malpractice. For purposes of period of limitation, what is the rational basis for treating one differently than the other in that fact scenario?
Well, Your Honor, I would just go back to what the court's reasoning in Carlson and this court's reasoning in Storm. I mean, in Storm, there was a series of negligent acts, and the requirement was that the mental illness predate and negligent act. I mean, it's a, you know, any line, a statute of limitations, it's no, some would argue that it's no more fair to cut off a person at 3 years than 3 years in a day. You know, all lines that are drawn by the legislature like this are going to have effect.
That argument seems to me to say that any time the legislature draws a line, that it is ipso facto devoid of any equal protection impediment, because after all, that's what the legislature does.
No, I mean, I don't think that that's true, Your Honor.
But, do I?
Right, but the line that's being drawn about whether it existed before or after, you know, there's a rational basis that would support that line. I mean,
I'm really having trouble because it's. It seems to me I have a hard time with my fact situation. Now, maybe if you give a different fact situation, I wouldn't. But where's, you know, if the disability is really going to continue for the entire period of time until age 10 or until age 18 plus 1 or whatever date you choose, you know, here, whether it's add 5 years on after they reach, you know, age 10, I mean, whatever you choose.
Well, let me give you some reasons why a legislature could rationally conclude that. First, this is tolling in addition to the underlying statute of limitations, right? It's giving an additional benefit to the party with a claim. And it's rational, I believe, for the legislature to conclude that should have some kind of limitations, that it should apply not open-endedly to any kind of disability that might arise at any point in time. I think that's a rational thing for the legislature to conclude. And at least in the malpractice context with minors, I think a critically important point is that minors don't bring their own actions. They're brought on the other parents. You know, like the 1 year that has a mental illness or, you know, is insane, they are no less able or less knowing of their rights than a 1 year old who doesn't have that disability. There's a little bit of a fiction going on as it relates to minors because parents have the time to bring the claim.
Mm-hmm.
So So how does that support your distinction then?
Well, I think it supports the distinction because that also is a rational reason why the legislature, you know, in the 1840s of the last 160 years would have drawn that line. They were trying not to have an open-ended disability tolling provision, because if it was open-ended, if it related to disability either before the cause of action accrued or afterwards, it could kind of undo all, it could undo all underlying statute of limitations.
That would seem to make sense with an adult who would make those decisions, but as you just pointed out, the decisions on behalf of a minor are usually made by the parent. So the disability, whether it pre-exists or not, really doesn't exist for the parent. The disability is with the child.
Right.
So if the disability is with the child, I'm trying to understand rationally, how does it make a difference whether the disability pre-exists or not? I can see the difference with an adult. I'm not sure I see the difference with a child.
My point is that because parents bring claims for on behalf of their children, that's another reason the legislature could have concluded that to not have an expansive disability tolling provision that could be triggered by any disability before or after. And again, I think it's useful to go back to the Mendel context and the legislative findings. The legislature was trying, viewed it as a problem to have kind of open-ended, thought 18 years was too long. But they wanted to reduce that to 10 because they thought that that was sufficient time, and they made that balance.
If I could ask one question about that, and would you agree with the characterization or disagree with the characterization that there appears to be a hole in the statute dealing with this particular category of individuals?
Well, that's a good question, Justice Butler. I mean, as I understand, I think there are arguably two holes that derive from the Court of Appeals decision. One is where disabled children completely excepted from any statute of limitations, and I've addressed that issue. I think it's an unduly stringent reading of 893.56. What they were really doing was just noting that those people could be subject to additional tolling, but that all children get 10 years. So that's one potential hole. The other hole that I think you're more specifically referencing is the inclusion of developmental disability in 893.56, but its exclusion in other places. And I mean, our view on that point is as follows. First, Justice Wilcox, I believe, or Justice Prosser were correct when they said that it is a handwritten amendment. It's, you know, this was discussed in Acre. It's not clear exactly what was intended by that. And in the 5 years since Acre, there's been no legislative action to correct that quote-unquote hole. But there's other reason to give, that you give the court pause to fill that hole. If you look at the statutes, 893, 16, 17, and 18, they all relate to disability tolling. And in all those sections, the only disabilities that are referenced are minority, insanity, and imprisonment. And in fact, you know, I did a skim of Chapter 893, and I don't believe there's another reference to developmental disability anywhere in the chapter, the entire chapter of limitations. And so then the question arises, you know, given that 893.16 applies to a whole host of limitations in 893, you know, it tolls for disability reasons a lot of different limitations, is a handwritten Senate floor amendment relating to a specific Med-Mal statute relating to children, can that be read to evince the legislative intent to adopt a new category of a disability in all contexts subject to 893? And I respectfully submit that it puts too much pressure on that one word or that two-word amendment to draw that conclusion. And another problem, I think, with going that route is that it's not clear where it gets inserted. It's not clear. Is it a subset of minority in 893.16? Is it subject to the requirement that the disability has to, you know, you can bring an action until the disability ceases? Because in cases like epilepsy or cerebral palsy, those are lifelong conditions. That would basically mean that there would be no limitations period at all. And it's not clear whether it's subject, it's like mental illness. I think there are just too many questions for the court to step in and fill a gap in 893.16.
Well, then what's the court to do?
I think, Your Honor, that the court, let me turn to the specific,
I want to know how you're going to read or rewrite 56. Because you have to rewrite 56.
Well, I don't think you have to rewrite 56, Your Honor.
Well, let's just look at it. Any person under the age, maybe you don't. Any person under the age of 18 who is not under a disability by developmental disability, right? That's what it says. Shall bring an action. So developmental disability is not under 56.
It's not what?
It's not covered by 56. I've got a person under the age of 18 but has developmental disability. So 893.56 doesn't cover them.
But my point, Your Honor, at the outset.
The language of the statute, does it cover them?
Your Honor, it does cover them if they're a minor. My
it says the minor is not having developmental disability.
I know, but, Your Honor, this
okay.
is...
just as long as the language does not cover it.
I know, Your Honor. The clause that you're reading, it's an unearthly way that the legislature was drafting not to indicate they were accepting these people from the scope of the minor statute. All they were doing was showing that these people could be subject to additional tolling based on the categories that weren't addressed in 893.16.
That's a very strange reading. I mean, it says who is not under developmental disability. If they wanted to say what you're saying.
Let me go with you on that, Your Honor. Let me show you where the ambiguity lies and how you get to the legislative history and how you'd reach that result.
I get to the legislative history under any conditions, so it doesn't matter. Okay. Let's look at the text first. I always look at the text.
But the key thing to look at the text is, at the time that 893.56 was adopted as 893.235, it was adopted at the same time as 893.33, right? And 893.33 says, except for actions against health care providers. It uses the word except. 893.56, or its predecessor, uses the word who is not under disability. If they wanted to accept that category, the disabled or the insane or the imprisoned, they could have said except for persons, so they wanted to accept them and send them someplace else. And so if you look at the legislative history, what that evinces is that they wanted all minor actions against health care providers thrown into 893.56.
They could have then just said any person under the age of 18 and left out that whole clause shall bring an action to recover damages from injuries for any omission within the time limitation under 55 or by the time the person reaches 10.
I agree.
A very simple way of doing it.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree. They could have done that. They could have also had another clause that said that if they have one of these additional things, they could get additional tolling. But I think the reason they did it the way they did, they were trying not to sow confusion. They wanted to...
really have been successful.
They failed in that regard. But the whole point of this exercise is what is their intent, though, right?
No. First you look at the language.
Okay.
And then you might look at the intent. And you think the intent was to shorten the time period for minors. Yeah, the 10 years.
That's right.
That's what E says.
That's right.
But there's nothing in E about disabled people.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the way you get there is if you look at where they put the except for actions against healthcare providers, they weren't carving out all medical malpractice, all actions at all. They were just carving out actions against minors. So that's a legislative intent shows that they moved all minor actions from 93.56. They moved them all, whether you're a disability or not. And what that clause means is it's like a placeholder saying, if you have these things, you might benefit from additional tolling. It sends them back to 893.16 if they're insane or imprisoned.
Oh, 893.16 talks about all kids under 18.
except for actions against health care providers.
So we don't get to 89316 because this is an action. This is an action against a health care provider.
Well, we believe, Your Honor, you do get to 89316 if you're in the other classes after the semicolon. That's what Storm held.
Yeah, but is this person insane? According to the statutes, insane is not developmentally, I don't mean statutes, cases, insane is not developmentally disabled, and mentally ill doesn't always mean insane. So you're not under the language of 89316.
Well, we agree, Your Honor, that 89316 doesn't apply to this case for the reasons that Justice Rogensack had articulated, that, you know, it doesn't predate, as evidenced by their pleadings. We also agree that developmental disability is not
in it. Into three. Let's stay with one.
Okay. We agree that they don't fall within those classes, which kind of dovetails into Justice Butler's question about whether there's something this court should fill. But at the end of the day, Your Honor, even if you read what we call the phrase in blue in 89356 is excluding them from the scope of 89356, I think it's clear that that phrase only relates to disabilities that existed at the time the cause of action accrued. It's a direct cross-reference to 89316.
There's no reference to 89316 in the statute.
They were enacted at the same time, and before the handwritten amendment on the floor of the Senate, it only related to imprisonment and insanity. And so, given that since 1842 at least, the only disabilities that could give rise to tolling are ones that existed at the time the cause of action accrued, I think you have to import that same limitation into 89356. It doesn't make sense otherwise.
Let me just ask you one question. What is the last time that this cause of action can be brought? What is the last date?
The Hagerman's cause of action?
Yes.
Okay. The Hagerman's cause of action, the latest time for them would have been the 10 years under 89356. Because they were a minor, that was subject to the minor statute. We don't get the benefit of additional tolling under 89316 because, A, they didn't have a pre-existing disability by the time the cause of action accrued.
That's subsection 3. Go ahead.
So, as this court indicated in Storm, as indicated in Carlson, and consistent with the line of cases that we've outlined in the brief going back to 1842, they also don't get the benefit of 89316 because developmental disability is not a recognized class for the reasons I just articulated to Justice Butler in his question. The issue is can you derive from that handwritten amendment in the statement in Acre some kind of intent where the legislature hasn't corrected it over the last 5 years? And then there's another reason which I'll just throw out to the court that I think is suggested by its decision in Storm. In Storm, the court applied 89316 to the injury accrual rule in 89355(1)(a). But it noted in a footnote, this is 196 note 23, that it was not going to apply, it was not reaching the issue of whether that kind of a tolling also related to, you know, that section, 89316, also told statutes of repose. And it said, quote, "The answer to this issue requires a deeper analysis of whether the legislature intended its reference to the periods of limitation prescribed in this chapter to include a statute of repose in addition to statutes of limitations." And in Acher, this court ruled that the 10-year period in 89356 was a statute of... I see my time is up.
Your time is up, and we need a new disc, so... Do you have one that's finished? Yes.
Sure. In Acher, this court ruled that the 10-year period in 89356 was a statute of repose, and so there's an unanswered question that the court didn't answer in Storm about whether you can even have disability tolling that relates to statutes as well. I mean, so for the Hagerman's claim to be timely in this case, they would require, you know,
a change to 893.16.3 about whether the disability predated or postdated the cause of action, it would require the insertion of developmental disability someplace in 893.16.1, and it would have to, it would require a determination that the disability total provision applied in all the statutes of repose.
How are we doing on that tape? Okay, go ahead.
And just in conclusion, I appreciate the indulgence. You know, the reason this court shouldn't go that route is that there is no inequity in this case because the Hafermans had 10 years to bring this claim. I mean, they were present at the birth, and under 893.56, they had 10 years. And you contrast this, and they didn't bring their claim, and you contrast this case with a case like Aker, where there's an eye injury at birth, you know, 6 months in which it accrued, but then the kid didn't go blind in one eye until they were 11. And in that case, the court held, even though they didn't even know about their injury or had a claim, that they were barred by the statutes of limitation and repose in 893.56. I mean, there's no such inequity in this case. They had 10 years. And we respectfully submit that the Court of Appeals decision should be affirmed based on the construction advanced here.
Different reasoning.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that 56 is the more applicable limitations in a post period.
Thank you, counsel. We're going to take a few moments, if we can, to change the tape, and then you will have Mr. Duffy 5 minutes in rebuttal.